Forests, fields, meadows, marshes, everything the avatars encountered was destroyed. The demigods were leaving a trail of ashes and scorched earth. It seemed to Tungdil that the men and dwarves, while far from pure, had done nothing to merit such a fate. "I don't think much of divine justice, if that's what it is. Not even the Alfar have wreaked such destruction on Gerdlegard." He threw the bulletins into the fire and watched as the paper crumpled. His thoughts returned to the Black Saddle and the dwarves who had died in the blaze. "The avatars are worse than Alfar, orcs and Bogdanlim combined." That night, he dreamed of Belindis and Mir. They were fighting for his favor. Belindis equipped with a blacksmith's hammer and a pair of metal tongs, and Mir wielding daggers. The duel was interrupted by Salfalor, who killed them both with his hammer. Tears streaming down his tattooed cheeks, he turned on Tungdil and charged. Tungdil woke with a start. Boindil was crouched next to him, shaking his shoulder.
"Come on, scholar! The White Army is on the move! Anyone would think they've got wind of our plans!"
Muttering and cursing, Tungdil clambered to his feet, put on his weapons belt, stuffed his blanket into his rucksack, and jogged to the front of the Thirdling battalions. The Thirdling generals had set off without him. If it hadn't been for Boindil, he would have woken by the campfire to find everyone had gone. He felt the eyes on his back as he made his way to the head of the army. Boindil was right. He would never trust a Thirdling in battle, even though he was a Thirdling himself. 82 miles southwest of Jon Balsur, Kingdom of Goregar, Gerdlegard, winter 6235th, solar cycle. Ondori turned her fireball and looked proudly at the unit of 4,000 warriors marching behind her through the night. They were stronger than ever, having partaken of the dark water and profited from its life-preserving power. The immortal siblings had ordered Ondori to lead the troops against Alendur and wipe out the elves. The elf couldn't have wished for a more glorious mission. A duel with Lord Lutisil would give her tremendous pleasure, and she was happy to delay her private campaign against the dwarves. Besides, with the help of the Dark Water, she could settle her score with Tungdil whenever she wanted. With a bit of luck and Teon willing, Ondori was hoping to put an end to Sitalia's elves. If the initial attack went well, she and her warriors would march on the rest of the kingdom and raise the leafy elven settlements to the ground. The immortal siblings' palace would be clad from top to bottom in shiny white elf bone, and Lutisil's skull would be skewered at the top.
What do we have here?
At the foot of a lone hill, she could make out the faint glow of a poorly hidden campfire.
Careless wayfarers.
She signaled for 2 dozen warriors to join her.
With any luck, they'll be elves.
They stole through the valley toward the hill. A shelf protruded from the hillside, affording shelter from rain and snow. At any other time, it would have made the perfect place to rest for a while. But the gods had deserted the travellers that night. Ondori reined in her bull and slid noiselessly to the ground. She heard snores from her victims and smelled the strong smell of tobacco on their clothes. After a few paces, she came to a boulder and ducked behind it, keeping to the shadows as she peered at the camp.
"Groundlings," she thought in astonishment, eyeing the ring of stocky warriors asleep around the dying fire.
Their sentry was perched on a rock, facing away from her, and smoking a pipe. Every now and then he dipped his tankard into a cauldron over the flames and took a sip of the steaming brew. Ondori did a quick head count, and came to 20 dwarves in total.
"What are they doing here? They can't be spies or scouts. They're in the middle of nowhere."
She signaled to her warriors that she wanted to question one of the groundlings. The others could be killed. Then she focused on the fire, willing the flames to die down.
The fire flickered briefly and went out. Cursing, the sentry clambered to his feet, placed some tinder on the embers, and kneeled on the ground to blow on the flames. Ondori detached herself from the shadows and crept toward him. Her movements were silent, and he didn't have time to react. Out of nowhere, a scythe-like blade sliced through his throat, and he toppled over, landing in the dying embers and dousing them with blood. The thud of his falling body caused one of his companions to stir. Three black arrows winged toward him as he raised his sleepy head. He sank back against his mattress as if overpowered by fatigue. The Alfar murdered their way systematically through the ring of sleeping dwarves, slitting their throats, ramming their narrow daggers between their eyes, and running their swords through their chests. Crouching beside the lone survivor, Ondori disarmed her victim and wrapped her quarterstaff against the ground. It was only when the dwarf sat up sleepily that Ondori realized she was female. The little creature reached for her axe, to no avail.
"Lie still," whispered Ondori, holding the dwarven axe above her head for her victim to see. She hurled it into the snow. "Scream, and we'll kill your friends, then you. Is that clear?"
The dwarf nodded, and Ondori detected the sound of grinding teeth.
"What are you doing here?" the elf demanded. "Hunting Alfar."
Ondori glowered.
"Trust a groundling to lie."
She peered at her victim's face.
"I've seen you before. You were at the mouth of the tunnel to the Grey Range. You shouted for Goldhand to help you, and I got away."
She smiled balefully.
"You're a queen, aren't you? Queen of the mob who moved into the halls. Are you sending an army to fight us? Are you scouts?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," the dwarf said stubbornly. "Our orders are to find out what's happening at the front. We're supposed to make a deal with the elves."
Ondori raised her quarterstaff sharply and pressed a hidden catch. A blade shot out from one end and came to rest on her captive's throat. There was a click as she locked the mechanism to prevent the blade retreating.
"I want the truth, groundling."
She swung her quarterstaff so that the blade hovered over the body of the dwarf to her right.
"Think of your friends," she whispered threateningly. "Do you want them to die?"
Her captive bristled.
"You won't hurt them, No Eyes," she said fearlessly.
Ondori rammed the blade into the heart of the seemingly sleeping dwarf. The trick worked. It was plain from her captive's face that she blamed herself for the death of her friend.
"That leaves 18 of you, including yourself. How many more lies are you going to tell me?" "You monster!"
Without warning, the dwarf thrust aside the quarterstaff and charged at the elf, who dived to the ground and rolled away nimbly to escape the dwarf's powerful hands.
"Too slow," crowed Ondori, kicking her under the chin.
The dwarf fell backward and lay limply on the ground.
"Inaste is smiling on me today," thought the elf. "The immortal siblings will be pleased to see my prisoner."
Dusting the snow from her clothes, she got up, only for the apparently unconscious dwarf to whip out a dagger and ram it into her calf. The blade tore through the leather upper of her boot and brought her to the ground.
"To arms!"
shouted the dwarf, scrambling toward the elf. She pointed the dagger at Ondori's throat.
"We've got an intruder in the camp!"
"Don't kill her,"
shouted Ondori, swallowing her pain.
"We need her alive."
She grabbed the dagger-wielding arm. The solidly built dwarf threw all her strength into avenging her dead companion. Four Alfar rushed to Ondori's aid and grabbed the dwarf from behind, tossing her roughly to the ground. Each held a leg or an arm, but the dwarf was still intent on breaking free. Ondori tore a strip from the cloak of a dead dwarf and tied it around her calf. The wound would heal of its own accord.
"Mountain vermin," she hissed,
ramming the blunt end of her quarterstaff into the dwarf's belly with all her might.
"We're taking you with us.
You're a queen consort and a good friend of Tungdil Goldhand.
She gave the order for the captive to be bound. Something tells me you're going to be very useful. She limped away, followed by her warriors and the dwarf. Their captive was as stubborn as a donkey, and they had to drag her through the snow. The Alfar themselves left no tracks. Ondori was glad to get back into the saddle. Her calf was still throbbing. The dark water, though able to close any wound, had no effect on the pain. She took the end of the rope with which she had trussed their captive and threaded it through a loop on Agris's saddle to tether the dwarf to her mount. She and her unit resumed their journey toward Alandor. After a time, Agris shook his head, nostrils flaring in the wind. Ondori understood the warning and sat up in the saddle. Turning, she saw something in the west.
What in Teon's name is that?
A long band of light was moving through Goregar, and it seemed to be heading straight for her homeland. It was travelling fast enough to reach the border in less than two orbits.
Have the humans found a new way of setting fire to the woods? She wondered,
surprised that the invaders had regained their courage so soon. She quickly discarded the idea. There was no lamp in Girdlegard, not even an elven lamp, that could give off such a light. It wasn't fire, either. It was too brilliant, too white.
Groundling!
Her foot connected with the back of the dwarf, who had come to a halt beside the bull.
Is this your doing?
The captive glared at her murderously and shrugged.
It might be. In other words, no. It looks like a tide of molten palladium.
In Ondori's mind, there could only be one answer to the riddle. Andukai. The humans must have convinced the Maegar to come up with a spell that would aid their armies against the Alfar. But the explanation wasn't entirely satisfactory. Andukai the Tempestuous was known for her stormy temper and her fondness for cataclysmic winds. She liked to surprise her enemies with sudden gales or cyclones. It wouldn't be her style to light up the sky like a beacon and alert the Alvish army to her approach.
What's going on?
Ondori had a bad feeling about the light, which was beginning to hurt her eyes.
Halt! She shouted. We're turning back!
She pointed at the luminous band.
Jean Balsur is under threat! The elves can wait!
Two of her guards rode off on shadow mares to spread the word among the troops. The other two stayed at her side. Eyes still fixed on the glow, she touched the symbol of Nagsor and Nagsar on her forehead. It was throbbing as if the skin were inflamed.
Ondori, said one of her guards, pointing south. What's that over there?
She stared into the distance and spotted a faint glow in the darkness. It was another strip of white light, this time much further away.
It's not a threat at the moment, she said confidently. Keep an eye on it, though. We don't want anyone to slip past us and attack from the north. Looks like we've got two armies to deal with, observed the guard, smiling. The immortal siblings will thank us for bringing them their bones.
Ondori rubbed her forehead, hoping to soothe the pain.
We can be sure of their gratitude.
She felt strangely ill at ease at the sight of the approaching light.
We should hurry. We need to find out who they are.
At daybreak, Ondori stood watching the soldiers in their gleaming white armor. The first rays of sunlight glinted on the polished metal, blinding her eyes. She couldn't decipher the runes on their banner, but she knew for certain that the soldiers weren't from Girdlegard.
20,000 foot soldiers and 2,500 riders, said one of her guards, surveying the unknown enemy. The immortal siblings should be warned. Our scouts are bound to have seen them,
Ondori assured him. She screwed up her eyes, dazzled by the glare.
They're sparkling like an army of diamonds. As soon as the sun goes in, we'll attack from behind, take some prisoners and retreat.
Ondori had fought soldiers from every army in Girdlegard, but none wore uniforms such as these.
Where are they from?
It seemed unlikely that the human generals could raise an army of foreign mercenaries without the rest of Girdlegard knowing. Alvish spies had been eavesdropping on the enemy camps in Jon Balsor for a good many orbits.
Whoever they are, they'll get a proper Alvish welcome, she said darkly, returning to her troops.
They followed the strange army at a distance until dusk, waiting for the sun to set. As the light began to fade, she ordered her guards to tie the dwarf to a tree and fill her mouth with snow to stop her dying of thirst.
We'll be back soon, Ondori assured her. As soon as we've finished here, we're taking you to the immortal siblings.
She waggled her leg tentatively. The dark water had healed the gash in her calf, and there was nothing to show that a dagger had sliced through her flesh. She climbed into the saddle and rode at the head of her troops. When they were close enough, she took cover and surveyed the tail end of the army. The situation wasn't to her liking. The soldier's armor had absorbed the sunlight and, despite the gathering gloom, was shining as brightly as ever, forcing Ondori to take an unusual precaution. She ordered her warriors to don strips of black cloth designed to protect them from snow blindness. Peering through slits in the fabric and still half dazzled by the light, they launched a stealth attack from the rear. Even as they advanced, Ondori began to doubt the wisdom of the scheme. The blessing on her forehead was burning against her skin, and Agras, rather than charging the enemy and trampling through the ranks, was snorting and bucking nervously. The battle got off to a disappointing start. The soldiers must have anticipated their attack. At any rate, they showed no sign of panic. As soon as the first enemy rider went down, struck by an Alvish arrow, the back row of infantry raised their shields to form a wall, which rose to the height of 3 paces, as the cavalrymen followed suit. Lances and halberds appeared through the cracks. At that moment, a midnight sun flashed into the sky above the Alfar, bathing them in cold white light. Ondori cried out and clutched her forehead. It felt as if liquid fire was coursing through the blessing inscribed there and searing her brain. The attack faltered.
So you are the Alfar of whom we've heard tell, said the sun. I can sense your corruption. You carry the spirit of Teon with you, and you live to further his works.
The sun became hotter, brighter.
All that is over. The Alfar shall threaten Girdlegard no more.
A wave of heat rolled over the Alfar, and a third of the troops caught alight. The burning warriors threw themselves to the ground, writhing in agony, trying to put out the flames, but to no avail. Ondori watched as the fiery presence drew closer and waited until it was almost above her, then dived beneath her bull, praying not to be trampled beneath its hooves. Eyes closed, she felt the searing heat pass over her like the fiery breath of a dragon. Crackling flames engulfed the warriors around her, and a stench of burning hair, clothes, and flesh filled the air. Agras kicked out frantically, striking her in the side. Then the terrible rush of heat was over. Ondori sprang to her feet and stared at her scorched and dying bull. The flames had melted its visor, sealing its fate.
"Pull back!" she shouted. "Make for the woods!"
Her voice was barely audible above the shouts and jeers of the unknown soldiers as they seized their chance and attacked. Riders on stallions charged fearlessly at the dark ranks of the Alfar, cutting them down with their swords. Ondori watched in horror as her warriors took blows to the limbs and torso and lay where they fell. The power of the dark water offered no protection against the dazzling riders' swords.
We're no stronger than ordinary mortals.
Aghast, she turned to flee. There could be no hope of victory against an enemy as powerful as this. Leaping over the bodies of her fallen comrades, she ran for the ash-covered trees. Hampered by the undergrowth, the riders stopped their pursuit. The foot soldiers blundered on, but none could match her speed. Ondori kept running, spurred on by the memory of the heat, oblivious to her aching lungs and throbbing legs. At last, she reached a clearing and slumped to the ground, exhausted. Soon after, she was joined by the rest of her unit, who arrived in dribs and drabs. There were 10 of them in all. The others had been cut down or consumed by fire.
"What happened?"
gasped one of the warriors. Ondori couldn't answer. Her lungs were screaming for air, and her forehead was on fire. She reached up to touch the skin above her mask, and her flesh fell away, exposing the white of her skull. Her fingers were covered in sticky black ash. She wiped them on the ground, digging her hands into the soil and crying with rage and agony. The noise reverberated through the night. Suddenly, a pair of battered boots stepped into view.
"What have we got here?" growled a deep voice.
A heavy object collided with the back of her head, and she slumped to the ground, unconscious. Chapter 6. 21 miles southwest of John Balsur. Kingdom of Gurugar, Girdlegard. Winter, 6,235th solar cycle.
"I know her because of the mask,"
said Tungdil, staring at the elf who was lying, wrists and ankles bound, in the snow by the fire. He and the others were waiting for her to open her eyes.
"She's the one who stole Keenfire.
She came after me in the Grey Range and swore to kill me." Boindil was gripping one of his axes, ready to dispatch their captive at the first sign of trouble.
"I'm tired of waiting," he complained. "We're only waiting because you walloped her over the head," his brother reminded him. "In that case, I'd better wake her,"
he said promptly, taking a handful of snow and hurling it at her face. They had stripped her of her mask to reveal a slender, well-proportioned countenance, universal to Alfar and elves. Tungdil was particularly interested to see the burns on her face. Some were the work of the avatars, but the rest had been left by Keenfire. The clump of snow bounced off and landed on the ground, leaving a few stray crystals that melted on the elf's warm skin.
Said Boindil. "She knows what it's like to get burned, so maybe fire will do the trick."
He bent down and picked up a glowing ember in his glove. The elf's eyes flew open.
"Put it down," she hissed.
"Ah, I knew it. The scheming No-Eyes is awake," crowed Boindil, lowering his axe toward her face.
"Do as we say, or I'll chop you up like a sausage."
Tungdil stepped forward.
"Now I know your face." "Tion will curse you for stripping me of my mask," she spat back. "You and your friends are doomed."
Rodario shook his head.
"Listen to the ferocious little polecat with the triangular ears."
He eyed her bonds.
"You can spit as much as you like, but we've trimmed your claws."
He struck what he hoped was an intimidating pose.
"My name is Rodario the Fablemaker, Famulus to Namora the Unnerving, and second most powerful magician in Girdlegard. I could destroy you right now if I wanted, but I'll spare your life if you—"
"Where's Keenfire?"
broke in Boindil, to the indignation of the impresario, who punished him with a theatrical glare.
"It wouldn't help if I told you," she hissed.
"Perhaps not," replied Tungdil. "But don't be surprised if someone else gets hold of it. The heart of your kingdom is about to fall."
"To the White Army?"
She raised her head and stared at Tungdil, her eyes full of hope.
"Does Keenfire have the power to stop them?"
"Ah, so it's in John," he concluded.
The elf fell silent, trying to make sense of the situation. While pretending to be unconscious, she had heard the dwarves discussing the invaders. It seemed to her that they were trying to halt the White Army's advance.
"You're not on their side," she reasoned. "Why are you trying to stop them? Don't you want John
to fall?
Who would have thought it? Exclaimed Rodario, surprised. The little pussycat doesn't know who they are. Haven't you heard the legend of the avatars?
On seeing the elf's puzzlement, he proceeded to explain the history of the demigods, throwing in the odd fantastical detail here and there to make the avatars seem more terrifying. He pointed into the distance.
And your warriors were consumed by the avatars, fiery crusaders of purity, descended from Teon, the god to whom you pray. Is that not deliciously ironic?
They won't stop until every last one of us is dead, said Ondoori slowly.
At last it made sense. Her nervousness before the attack, the searing pain in her forehead, the failure of the dark water. And she knew without a doubt that John Belsir would fall to the invaders, unless...
A bitter irony indeed. Our survival depends on those who seek to destroy us.
Actually, began Tungdil, looking at her gravely, we're asking you to join us. We need to fight together if we're to drive them out.
We can't fight them, groundling,
she said with a shudder, remembering the murderous wave of heat and light.
It's like asking a snowball to put out the sun.
It depends on the size of the snowball, he replied, cutting her bonds. Forget the enmity between us, and hurry back to John to tell your leaders what you've heard. We'll need every warrior in Girdlegard if the avatars are to be stopped.
I will deliver your message.
Ondoori picked up her mask and slipped it over her head, hiding her scars. A woman in black leather armor appeared before her. Her face was slender, too slender for a human.
My name is Namora the Unnerving. Andakai the Tempestuous was my teacher, she said in Alvish.
Her accent was abysmal and her pronunciations atrocious, but Ondoori understood.
Tell the immortal siblings that the Alfar must join our troops. We won't fight your battles unless you're prepared to risk your lives as well.
Her eyes darkened with menace.
We can always stand by and watch the avatars raise your homeland to the ground. I'd be happy to provide directions to the royal palace. Tell Nagsor and Nagsar to think very carefully before refusing our request.
She's one of us,
Ondoori nodded reluctantly.
I'll tell the immortal siblings, she rasped,
shaking the ropes from her wrists. She straightened up.
Swear on your blood that you'll do it, the Magus said darkly, grabbing the elf's left arm and cutting a gash in the back of her hand.
She held the glistening blade in front of the elf's face.
Break your word, and I'll destroy you. My magic will follow you like a huntsman follows his prey.
Ondoori nodded meekly. Namora's threat was all too believable.
I swear I'll do it, she stammered. You can trust me, I promise. There's a groundling near here.
She quickly described the place where she had left her captive, then hurried away, vanishing into the night.
What the blazes did you say to her?
Asked Boindil suspiciously.
Do you have to speak in that tongue?
It depends on whether you want to help a poor dwarf who's waiting to be rescued, she said, smiling. Her eyes had returned to their normal color.
I'll send Jeroen to fetch her, unless you'd rather go.
She needn't have asked. No dwarf could stand by when one of their kinsfolk was in trouble. So Boindil left with Tungdil, his brother, and 30 volunteers to release the captive dwarf. They soon found the place. Someone had gotten there before them, as they could tell from the melted snow and footprints in the sludge. A rope was wrapped around the tree trunk, marking the place where the dwarf had been tied up.
The avatars beat us to it, said Tungdil, trudging around the tree in the hope of finding something that might identify the missing dwarf.
Amidst the footprints, half buried in the slush, he found a broken necklace of beautiful steel links and gold balls. He recognized it at once.
Palindis, he gasped,
picking up the chain and wiping it lovingly on his jerkin. The avatars had kidnapped his one true love, and with her, the instructions for forging Jerun's armor.
"One darned problem after another," grumbled Boindil. "I don't mind a challenge, but this is a joke."
Boindal laid a comforting hand on Tungdil's shoulder.
"It's a sign that we have to destroy them, scholar. Don't worry, we won't let your Belindis come to any harm."
"She's not my Belindis, remember?" Tungdil fastened the necklace around his wrist, over the neckerchief given to him by Frala, his childhood friend who had died at the hands of the orcs. "I'll get her back regardless, even if I have to take on the avatars myself."
"I know she forged the iron band with Gleimbar," Boendil said simply, "but she'll always be your Belindis."
He paused, hesitating.
"I wish Vrakas would make her properly yours."
"So do I," thought Tungdil sadly. Tungdil and the twins led the unit of 10,000 thirdlings on a forced march to outflank the Avatar's army. On reaching the forest on the outskirts of Jon Balsur, they came to a halt. Tungdil ordered the bulk of the warriors to block the path that the allies had blazed through the woods. Two battalions of 1,000 warriors apiece hid in the trees on either side. After a while, the masked Alf appeared and told them that her kinsfolk had agreed to a temporary ceasefire. Most of the dwarves had guessed as much, having been neither struck down by quarterstaffs nor feathered with treacherous arrows. Others before them had met with a harsher fate. Tungdil and his comrades were appalled to see that the Alpha had erected sculptures made of human corpses to mark their victory over the allied troops. The branches were festooned with flags made of human skin, embellished with symbols painted in blood. The summer months had taken their toll on the artwork, but the autumn frosts had saved them from further decay, and a fine layer of snow covered the sculptures and flags like a clean white cloth, hiding the grisly details. Tungdil and his friends were tempted to leave the Alpha to their fate. If the thirdlings were nervous, they didn't show it. Their tattooed faces looked unerringly to the south as they waited in silence for the avatars to arrive. Shield in one hand and weapon in the other, they stood shoulder to shoulder in disciplined rows. The sight of the thirdling warriors made a big impression on Boindil, who, like his brother, refused to move from Tungdil's side. Without discussing the matter, they had decided that Tungdil needed protection from Lorimbas's warriors, and they saw it as their duty to watch his back. The dwarven folks had united against the avatars, but they still regarded each other with mutual distrust. The afternoon was almost over when a scout came running to make his report.
"They're here," he panted. "The avatars are coming, but Lorimbas's unit is half an orbit behind. I saw them on the horizon."
Tungdil thanked the scout and sent him to join the thirdling ranks.
"Half an orbit until Lorimbas gets here," he told the twins. "We'll have our work cut out."
He remembered how quickly the avatars had dispatched the unit of 4,000 Alpha.
"We'll be lucky if we survive." "It won't be easy, but it's not impossible," said Boindil, trying to be upbeat.
He had drawn one axe, now he drew the other. Several hours later, a warm wind blew in from the south. The avatars were approaching. Tungdil instructed his runners to take a message to the leaders of each battalion.
"Tell them to stay in formation. When they see the fire coming, they need to lift their shields, drop to the ground, and let the flames pass overhead."
They heard the thundering hooves. The Avatar's cavalry swung round and came to a halt in two long lines. An advance guard of foot soldiers raised their swords and spears, ready to form a buffer between the horses and the enemy in the event of a counterattack. The dwarves watched impassively, waiting for the light to become stronger and brighter before tying scarves around their heads to protect their eyes. A gleaming figure detached itself from the enemy ranks and hovered above the ground. Slowly, it glided toward the dwarves, leaving a trail of melted snow in its wake. 10 paces from Tungdil, it came to a halt. The light was too bright for him to make out its features.
"You are the dwarves," said a voice of infinite kindness. "For thousands of cycles, you and your forebears fought for Gerdligard and defended its borders against Teon's hordes. We share a common goal. Why do you seek to destroy us?"
"You and your brothers must leave these lands," called Tungdil. "Your presence is harmful to Gerdligard, to the ground beneath you, to our villages and towns."
"We have a mission, Tungdil Goldhand,"
the voice replied amicably.
"Gerdligard is infested with Alfar, ogres and orcs. We won't leave these lands until Teon's beasts have been destroyed and their master humiliated. Ridding you of this plague will give us new strength. The time will come when Teon himself won't be safe from our wrath."
The Avatar edged closer, and the temperature rose a few degrees.
"Let us pass, and no harm will come to you or your kinsfolk."
His shimmering hand pointed to the north.
"Our quarrel is with the inhabitants of the city, not you.
Think what your strength will do to our lands. We can't allow you to boost your powers." Tungdil raised his shield, expecting to be dazzled by ferocious white light. "Our mission is to protect Gerdligard from harm, and you're harmful to Gerdligard. We can't let you pass, not even if..."
Jerun charged forward. He covered the distance in three giant strides and grabbed the Avatar by the neck, wrapping his hands around his throat and tightening his grip. The Avatar screamed and enveloped itself in searing light. Jerun was bathed in fire, but he didn't let go. The smell of hot metal filled the air, and shouts went up from the enemy ranks. Just then, there was a loud ripping noise, like a curtain being torn in half. It was accompanied by cracking bones. The light disappeared, and Jerun roared in triumph. When the dwarves looked up, he was holding the Avatar's head in one hand and his body in the other. The Avatar's face, clearly visible against the grey sky, looked unmistakably human. It belonged to a man of some 30 cycles whose beige robes were drenched in blood. The colossal warrior tossed the Avatar's dripping remains through the air, and they hit the snow, bouncing a few times before coming to rest. Contrary to expectations, the Avatar's head didn't reattach itself to his body in a blaze of supernatural light. The man was an ordinary mortal.
"Knock me down with a hammer," gasped Boindil. "Did you see how he wrung his neck? As easy as killing a chicken."
"He was just a man," whispered Narmora, laughing in relief. "Jerun must have known from the smell. The light and fireworks were meant to trick us. They're conjurers, not avatars."
Tungdil's worries, not least how he was going to rescue Belindis if he didn't survive the orbit, melted away, and he laughed out loud. The merriment spread through the ranks, and soon the forest was echoing with mocking dwarven laughter that continued long after the cavalrymen began their charge. The riders no longer looked so intimidating. The death of the Avatar had robbed their armor of its sheen. Boindil raised his axe and his shield.
"Aim for the horse's knees and let the riders come to you," he shouted, spoiling for a fight.
Confidence had returned to the dwarven ranks. Shouting a ferocious war cry, Tungdil and his 8,000 warriors ran out to meet the charge. The speedy death of the first Avatar, whose remains disappeared under the stampede of dwarven boots, was followed by a grueling battle with the enemy army. Incensed by the fate of their leader, they threw themselves vengefully upon the dwarves, who struggled against the cavalry's superior maneuverability and speed. The horses crashed through their ranks with such force that gaps appeared in the rows of shields, allowing enemy foot soldiers to surge through the openings and wreak havoc with the dwarven defences.
"Fall back!" yelled Tungdil, ordering the surviving warriors to retreat to the forest.
At once the hidden units of thirdlings
leaped out from the trees to beat back the enemy troops. "Don't let up," Tungdil urged them. "It's almost sundown. Your king will be here soon." At that moment, a second luminous figure appeared before them, but this time the Avatar was careful not to come too close. Hovering 3 paces above the ground, it stayed behind the enemy lines and bombarded them with fireballs. It took all Namora's power to deflect the missiles and hurl them back at the enemy troops. The Avatar, realizing he had found a worthy opponent, gave the command for his soldiers to stop the magic at its source. Calling for the twins to follow, Tungdil rushed to Namora's aid, but the enemy soldiers got there first, and the half-elf disappeared in a melee of bodies and swords.
"We've got to save her," he told the others.
Boindil led the attack, with Boendal and Tungdil behind, and between them they cut a path through the enemy troops. Thanks to Boindil's twin blades, Boendal's crow's beak and Tungdil's axe, they proceeded in a straight line, aiming for the spot where Namora had last been seen. By the time they reached her, she was under attack from all sides. Meanwhile, the Avatar was bombarding her with curses and spells. The Thirdlings were putting up a spirited defense, and Jerun was standing among them, sword in one hand, cudgel in the other, killing knots of soldiers with every blow. But it was only a matter of time before the Maegar's defenses crumbled, as the enemy was aware. A heavily perspiring Namora was tracing symbols and spells in the air.
"I'm not strong enough to beat the Avatar," she gasped. "I can't hold them off for much longer, and Jerun can't get close enough to attack."
She deflected a fireball and sent it crashing among her assailants, a dozen of whom perished in the blaze. Tungdil wondered whether he should order the Thirdlings to clear a path for Jerun to tackle the Avatar.
But where are the other 9?
Since the start of the battle, he had been steeling himself for a wave of fire to wash over his warriors, as the elf had described.
What are the Avatars up to? Why are they letting us kill their troops?
He decided to stop worrying and take charge of the attack. He and the twins led the way with the Thirdlings at the rear. Despite being heavily outnumbered, Lorimbas's warriors inflicted heavy losses on the enemy troops, but the odds were stacked against them. As evening drew in, Tungdil's counterattack ground to a halt. Suddenly, help arrived on the scene. A dark shadow crossed the sky, rippling overhead like a vast flock of birds. It was followed soon afterward by metallic jangling, as hundreds of black-fletched arrows embedded themselves in enemy mail.
"It's about time the blasted No-Eyes decided to help," snorted Boindil, blocking an enemy sword.
He knocked the weapon from the soldier's hand and drove an axe into his unprotected thigh.
"I won't be sorry when this is over. Avatars, Thirdlings, and Alpha."
He aimed a blow at the next soldier's hip, cutting through his armor and slicing into his flesh.
"I'm starting to feel dizzy from keeping tabs on them all."
Boendal raised his crow's beak and swung the pole against a helmed head, crushing the skull. The soldier fell backward against his comrades.
"Stop whirling about like a spinning top and focus on what's ahead," he instructed his brother.
He wiped the sweat and blood from his face with the end of his beard.
"Head straight for the Avatar."
Alvish arrows whistled and whined through the air, bringing death to the enemy troops. The Avatar's soldiers seemed to realize that the tide had turned against them, and the bulk of the army began to retreat, shields raised against the feathered storm. The time had come for Jerun to attack. Leaving Namora, he surged forward, killing anyone foolish enough to bar his path, his sword and cudgel sweeping left and right with deadly force. Within moments, he had fought his way through to Tungdil and the twins. Lifting off with unexpected agility, he soared 7 paces through the air, flying over helmets, heads, and shields, and touching down at the heart of the action, within striking distance of the Avatar. The glowing figure unleashed a bolt of crackling white luminescence at his chest.
The magic energy thudded against his breastplate, causing the runes on his armor to pulse with light, but Jerun was unharmed. Ricocheting back toward the Avatar, the bolt seared through the pack of enemy soldiers, allowing the armored giant to advance. Once again he called upon his incredible strength, thrusting his metal-clad arms into the light. For a few moments the glow intensified, then an agonized scream rent the air, and the light was extinguished. Roaring, Jerun brandished his victim's body. The head was twisted unnaturally to the side. A purple glow emanated from the warrior's visor, like a radiant expression of pride. He seemed to enjoy his victory, holding the corpse on high and showing it to the enemy troops. At last, he tossed him away like an unwanted toy. The dead man flew through the air, landing on the pikes and halberds of the enemy army. There was silence on the battlefield. The Avatar's army had accepted the death of the first Avatar as an unfortunate accident, but the death of the second was irrefutable proof that the Avatars were neither invincible nor immortal. The dead wizard's blood trickled down the shafts of the weapons like that of an ordinary mortal. There was nothing divine or pure about him.
"Attack!" shouted Tungdil exultantly. "Don't let them regroup!"
His axe slammed into a shield, cutting through the metal and severing an enemy wrist. A man fell screaming to the churned-up ground. The battle began again, but this time Tungdil's warriors had victory in their sights. Even as the Alfar emerged from the trees and threw themselves on the enemy, dwarven bugles heralded the arrival of the rest of the army, with Lorimbas, Zamtis, and Gemmel at the fore. Meanwhile, Jerun was in mortal danger. The White Army's pikemen had made it their mission to bring down the Avatar's killer, and they closed in on the giant, lunging at him with their long-handled weapons and retreating out of range. From time to time he cut down a pikeman, only to be attacked by another four. Boindil noticed Jerun's plight.
"We'd better help old Buckethead. He's overextended."
Glancing at Tungdil and Boendal, he saw agreement in their tired faces.
"It would be a shame to lose him after ev-"
"Look out!"
shouted Boendal, hefting his crow's beak and hurling it through the air. The powerful weapon ripped toward a rider who was charging spear in hand toward the giant's back. The rider saw the crow's beak coming and ducked just in time. Meanwhile, Jerun was too busy fighting the pikemen to notice the thundering hooves. Startled, he turned at the last moment, and the spear pierced his side. The rider paid for his bravery with his life, the giant's cudgel smashing against his chest. At once, the pikemen surged forward, falling on the injured giant and forcing him to the ground. Tungdil and the twins lost sight of their ally.
"Quick!"
shouted Tungdil, alerting the Maegar to the danger. Namora fixed her eyes on the skirmish, but Jerun was lost from view.
"I can't see him!"
she called back, sending a flickering tongue of fire in the direction indicated by Tungdil.
"Wait! I'll burn a path!"
The dwarves nodded and readied themselves to sprint after the next fiery bolt. Neither Tungdil nor the twins had any inkling that the Maegar wasn't prepared to come to the giant's rescue. Jerun had been useful on occasions, not least by revealing that some types of armor were resistant to magic, but he had played a key role in the plot against Fergus, and Namora could never forgive him for that.
"If he dies, he dies. If he lives, it won't be long before he falls in another skirmish."
She gazed after Tungdil and the others, who were leading a unit of thirdlings to save the injured giant.
"They can risk their lives if they want to. I'm not wasting my magic on him."
Getting past the pikemen was the toughest challenge yet. The advancing dwarves came to a halt in front of a bristling mass of long-handled halberds and pikes. Steel pikeheads pointed menacingly toward them, keeping them at bay. Every now and then a weapon sped forward, injuring any who sought to cleave the shafts.
and cut a path to Jerun, who was somewhere behind the blockade.
"That does it!" snorted Ironheart. "I'll teach them what it means to rile a dwarf."
His level-headed brother pulled him back.
"They'll run you through like a pig on a spit."
He was stopped from saying anything further by the arrival of a band of tall archers, who took up position next to them and leveled their bows. A flurry of arrows ripped toward the enemy with deadly effect. A path opened up between the pikemen, nearly 2 paces wide.
"Go on, then,"
said a voice that Tungdil recognized as Ondori's.
"Hurry!"
"I don't like it,"
said Ironheart suspiciously. He leaned across and whispered in his brother's ear.
"What if they shoot us in the back?"
"You die, of course," said Ondori, smiling. "But we're not going to shoot you. For the time being, we're on the same side."
Looking up, she saw that a gap had closed, so she ordered her archers to loose another hail of arrows.
"Hurry, Goldhand!"
She raised her bow and knocked an arrow to the string.
"The pikeman won't kill you. I want that pleasure myself."
Her grey eyes were cold with hatred. Remembering Jerun's plight, Tungdil had no choice but to trust her. He sent a quick prayer to Vrakas and charged into the breach, followed by Boindil, Boendal, and the Thirdlings. Even though he had promised himself he wouldn't, he glanced over his shoulder to check on the elf. She was standing ramrod straight, a knocked arrow pointing at his heart. Even as he stared, the bowstring released and the arrow shot toward him. Closing his eyes, he braced himself for the feathered missile to hit. Nothing happened. By some miracle, the elf had missed her mark. She lowered her bow and pointed ahead. Turning back, Tungdil saw the outstretched body of a soldier, felled by a single arrow. In his distraction, he had almost impaled himself on an enemy pike.
"It's my own fault for not trusting her. She hates me too much to let me die."
He leapt over the pikeman and threw himself into battle. But Jerun was nowhere to be seen. Ironheart, thrilled to be in striking distance of the pikeman, rampaged through the enemy ranks. In the crush of bodies, the pikemen were forced to rely on short swords, which gave little protection against hefty dwarven clubs, axes and hammers. Suddenly, the battle shifted in favour of the dwarves, who weren't in the mood for sparing lives. The enemy was shown no mercy. By nightfall, the Avatar's army had been destroyed, and the woods of Jon Balsur were strewn with corpses. It was then they found Jerun. He was lying among the dead soldiers, and he didn't stir when they called his name and shook him by the shoulder. Yellow blood was trickling from countless holes in his armor, forming a vast puddle around his battered body. Tungdil shouted for Namora's help.
"I don't want anyone closer than 10 paces, she told them. "You mustn't see what I'm doing. The magic could kill you."
She bent over Jerun's head and covered herself with her cloak. Then she opened the visor. The purple glow had gone out, and the sockets in his terrible skull were empty and lifeless. Namora felt neither sorrow nor satisfaction at his passing. Jerun was a killing machine, Andokai's killing machine. He shouldn't have done what he did to poor Fergus. Closing the visor, she lifted her cloak and got to her feet.
"He's dead," she announced. 2 avatars died by Jerun's hand. May his name live on in our memory."
She made her way over to Tungdil.
"Any sign of Belindis?"
Boindil shook his head crossly.
"I don't understand. What the blazes have they done with her?"
"I'd like to know where the other so-called avatars have got to," said Tungdil distractedly.
He was frantic with worry for the missing smith.
"Jerun killed 2. Which leaves another 9.
"Maybe there were only 2 in the first place," suggested Namora. "I've had a look at their bodies, and they seem like ordinary humans to me." She showed the dwarves some artifacts that she had found on the bodies.
"Amulets, rings, crystals, if you ask me, they weren't demigods at all.
take away their paraphernalia, and they'll be helpless.
You mean they made all that light with a few magic trinkets?
Said Boindil, amazed. The Maegar nodded. It was some kind of spell. They wanted to make us think they were gods. She pointed to a dead soldier. See the moonstone on his gorget? It's charmed. Without the moonstone, the armor wouldn't glow.
What a con!
Growled Boindil, turning to the impresario who had just joined their group.
They're as bad as you, pretending to be something better than they are.
I think I deserve a little more respect, protested Rodario. I convinced them I was a real Magus, and I nearly got killed for my pains. For once, he seemed to be telling the truth. His robe had been slashed to ribbons, but he was otherwise unharmed. Without warning, the Alf appeared alongside them, like a sinister suspiration of the night. Ironheart whipped out an axe and brandished it menacingly.
Get back, Alf! The battle's over and we're enemies again.
If our alliance were over, you'd be lying face down on the ground, she said scornfully. I came to tell you that I know what happened to the other avatars. Several orbits ago, I saw two lights in the distance, one heading for Jon Balsur and the other traveling west. I think they've split their troops.
Without us noticing? Ha!
Boindil laughed. Groundlings will sleep through anything. I could creep up on a dwarven encampment and slit a dozen throats without waking a soul. She gave them a long, hard look.
Trust me. I know.
Fortunately, Tungdil and Boendal grabbed their friend before he could throw himself on Ondori. He struggled vigorously and hurled curses in the Alf's direction.
Where would they be heading? Asked Tungdil. Why would they be going west? It's the wrong direction for ogres or orcs.
He thought about what he knew of the legend.
One part of the story is true. They seem to get their magic power by destroying evil. They must be looking for something evil to destroy.
Namora went white.
Perista, she whispered. Perista?
Echoed Rodario, taken aback.
Perista is a nice enough place. In fact, I rather like it. The people are friendly enough, although some of the men are overly jealous.
I wasn't referring to the population, Namora said sharply. Leos Nudin is the wellspring of Gerdegard's magic. The source of the energy is in the vaults. Nodon corrupted the force fields to stop the other Magi using them. But Andakai wasn't affected because she prayed to Sanusin, god of light and dark. She taught me to do the same. Tungdil had an idea what the avatars were planning.
And the force fields are still corrupted, even though Nodon is dead.
Namora nodded.
It sounds to me that Perista would make a good target, said Tungdil. How much damage can they do? Asked Boendal. The force fields may be tucked out of sight, like the stratum of rock beneath a mountain. But aren't they also vital? What if the avatars destroy them? They can't do that, can they? Asked Tungdil, alarmed.
I don't know for sure, Namora admitted. I expect we could find an answer, but the archives are in Perista. She gasped and looked at Fergus.
Dorsa!
The alliance still holds, Ondori said coolly. You should be grateful to the avatars. They've earned you a reprieve.
Tungdil gazed at the carnage around them. This is just the beginning, Vrakus.
Of the 30,000 dwarves, including 22,000 thirdlings, only 20,000 or so had survived the first battle. And now they would have to lay siege to a city and take on 9 Magi and an unknown quantity of warriors. Tungdil knew he couldn't count on the humans or the elves. The former had been fatally weakened by the defeat at Jon Balsur, and the latter would never agree to join forces with the Alfar. He decided to send a messenger to Alandor anyway.
We're the only ones who can stop them. It's up to us.
Tungdil turned in the direction of the grey range and gazed into the darkness. The defense of Girdlygard is our Vrakas-given duty, he said staunchly. For some reason, he was certain that Belindis was still alive.